You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and, well, 2022 found room for one more great snooker story. Mark Selby winning the English Open in Brentwood here this evening. Incredible turnaround. Go back to January, the Masters. He lost and was very down, tweeted about struggles that he'd long since kept buried, and finally was going to try and do something about. We didn't see much of after that last season. He took time out to work on himself, get the help that he needed, and also in doing so and talking about his mental health struggles helped a lot of other people, I'm sure. And the season started to play okay, starting to play well, but it had been a while since he won a trophy. 20 months actually. Last year in which he failed to win a trophy of any sort was 2009, and it looked like that great run of winning one every year since 2010 was going to end. But no, he lasted the course. Sean Murphy should have beaten him in the last 16. He missed a black, would have been on the next red, that would have been it, but he didn't. Selby played so well in the second half of the match against Ali Carter, and in particular, of course, against Neil Robertson in the semi-finals. That was a classic. And then in the final, he was just a bit too strong for Luca Brasel. It wasn't a classic final, but it was an amazing story. Very emotional scenes afterwards. Mark and his wife Vicky both in tears. They're there with their daughter Sophia, the whole family celebrating a triumphant end to what's been a difficult year. So, hey, you know, these stories, I suppose they happen at Christmas in a way, don't they? But it just shows what a great champion Mark Selby is. And as I said on the commentary, you know, his other family is the snooker circuit. He's very well liked by the other players, by the people on the circuit, because he's always been so friendly and down to earth. So a lot of people very happy for him. And let's hope that, you know, he's turned a corner now, turned a page in the great story of his life. And into 2023, it'll be dangerous, won't it, at the Masters and all the other tournaments. So congratulations to Mark. This is a short podcast because there'll be a much longer one coming later in the week. The Christmas special. Once again, joining forces with Nick Metcalf and Phil Hague from Talking Snooker. So the Christmas special will be coming up. And that will be later in the week, and who knows how long it will be. Last year it was too long, really, you know, nearly 3 hours. But I think we'll try and be a bit more manageable this year. But anyway, looking forward to that. So that will be available on all the usual offices, you know, that will be looking back on the year. But I think what we've seen here this evening, you know, was a very special moment. So to the emails, and I've had a few from people who've attended in Brentwood, and we always like to hear the experiences firsthand of snooker fans. So we start with Stephen Mercer. He said, "I've just discovered your brilliant snooker podcast, and it's now my daily accompaniment, catching up on the back catalogue when walking the dog." Poor old dog. having to suffer. Anyway, he says, "I attended my first tournament at the Crucible in 1984, when the embassy PR ladies were still handing out free fags to the punters. My mate and I saw Terry Griffiths playing Paul Mifsud in one of the early rounds." See, this is already niche stuff, isn't it? Paul Mifsud from Malta, yeah. That's a little long time ago, isn't it? Anyway, he says, "I'm by no means a super fan, but I've visited quite a few venues, including the old Wembley Conference Centre, the Hexagon, Ali Pally, and the EIS in Sheffield for the World Qualifiers, Crawley, Berlin for the German Masters, the MK Arena, the Morningside Arena in Leicester, probably a few others I've forgotten too. Well, I'll be honest, Stephen, you sound like a bit of a super fan. But anyway, he says, you mentioned you'd like to hear about fans' experiences of the different tournaments and venues. So I thought I'd write and let you know my thoughts about the English Open in Brentwood, which I visited yesterday. I should mention I was born and grew up in Brentwood, so I was excited to see a world ranking title event was going to be held there and immediately bought my ticket. Back in the 1980s, when the Brentwood Centre was first built, local rumour had it that Barry Hearn refused to hold any matchroom events there because Brentwood Council wouldn't stump up the money to finance a dedicated road junction off the A12 for better road access. You'll have seen when you drove there, it's an absolute nightmare to get to during any major event because you have to come off the A12 miles away and drive through the town. It's way out on the outskirts, away from any facilities, and it's on the opposite side of town from the railway station. It's also funny you mentioned the snow, which seems to occur whenever there's a snooker event on there. As I recall going to see an exhibition at the centre back in the late 90s when Alex Higgins turned up late because of really bad fog. Maybe it does have a bad weather jinx. Anyway, to the event itself, it was one of the best days of snooker I've ever watched. After seeing the hawk in the morning session, this is Monday he would have gone, by the way. So he's, after seeing the hawk in the morning session, I witnessed no less than 8 world champions in action in the afternoon and evening. Robertson, Selby, Bingham, Murphy, Doherty, O'Sullivan, Higgins and Trump. All this for a mere £12 a day, all day ticket. I paid more than 3 times that to see a very mediocre match in a crummy seat at the Masters at Ali Pally. There was a packed audience for Ronnie's match and I was sitting next to a group of very enthusiastic and vocal Belgian Ben Merton supporters. What a brilliant atmosphere for a fantastic match. I did feel Ronnie was not giving the young lad enough respect early in the match, going for silly shots and not seeming to take it seriously, but the young fella held himself together incredibly well and the crowd really warmed to him. As for the Brentwood Centre as a venue, well, I thought it was average at best. There's plenty of parking, and there was a catering marquee. The toilets seemed wholly inadequate, just 2 urinals and 1 stall for the gents, so I wouldn't like to be caught short during the interval of the final. But I'm sure there are others that they could open up. The rest was just standard sports centre fare. There's nothing wrong with that. The seating was okay, and certainly not as cramped as Ali Pally, as long as you go for an early session in the tournament before seats become allocated. If you arrive early enough, you can pretty much get a ringside seat to see your favourite stars. The only other criticism I'd make is that someone must have forgotten to put 50p in the meter because it was absolutely freezing in the arena. Hopefully you might find some of all of this contribution worthy of inclusion. Thanks again for putting together the excellent podcast. Well, thanks, Stephen. And yes, well, the heating on the Monday did actually, I believe, completely break down. That's why it was cold. I think it got better, I think, as it went on. But anyway, thank you for your main thumbs up. It's good that you had it on your doorstep after all these years. Now, Mark and John from London, they're also there. Just home from a great day in Brentwood watching the English Open. Not the most glamorous venue and surrounded by snow. But as always, our interactions with staff and players and the quality of the snooker and your commentary made it a very enjoyable day. Sorry to hop back to the UK Championship, but we noticed something the TV pundits seem to have missed. There was much talk of the new format, and that 7 of the top 16 went out in the first round in York. It was suggested the new format may not have helped them. However, when we look back over the last few years, it seems that to have 9 of the top 16 players getting the last 16 stage is in fact above average. Here's a brief list of the number of top 16 players who reached the last 16 in previous years. Okay, so we have 2015, 6. So there's a number of top 16 players in the last 16. 2015, 6. 2016, 7. 2017, just 4. 2018, 10. 2019, 8. 2026, 2021, 5, and this year, 2022, 9. They say it seems they normally reduce throughout the early rounds, and the new format didn't change anything. Seeing 7 go out the last 32 stage created the illusion something was different. Looking forward to your podcast in 2023. Well, thank you. Well, of course, I suppose the difference is this year, because they came in at the last 32 stage, if they lost in that stage, that's the only time you got to see them. At least in previous years, you would have seen them in the earlier rounds. So in terms of, if you say you wanted to go and watch, I don't know, let's pick one, who lost in the first round, Neil Robertson. That's the only match Neil Robertson played this year in that last 32. Anyway, thank you for that. And we had another one from a listener who's been to the English Open, Danny Kyle. He says, a few thoughts on attending the English Open. The venue itself wasn't too bad. In some ways, a bit of a victim of his own success. Strangely, for a home nations event, there weren't really enough seats available to cater for demand during the multi-table setup. This led to the odd situation on Friday afternoon when there appeared to have been more tickets sold than the number of seats with a reasonable view of the single table in operation. Many people had to sit in the blocks to the side and have a restricted view of the table, having to look sideways through the lighting truss or through the seating railings. Not ideal. It was great to see a large heated marquee outside with ample space to sit and a good selection of food and drink. This was in addition to the fairly good cafe in the centre. If this was set up just for the snooker, then it's a great effort and much appreciated. The toilet situation was unacceptable, however. Now, here we've got toilets didn't get the thumbs up earlier, did it? It's unacceptable, he says. The male toilet had space for a total of three people during an event where several hundred people went to use the facilities during the specific 15-minute breaks. This alone, unfortunately, would put me off attending future busy sessions here. One thing the venue can't change is its location, which is not walkable from any hotels, and just about accessible on public transport, but only during certain times of the day. I witnessed a few visitors with limited English getting confused about why they couldn't use their Oyster cards on the half-hourly bus from Brentwood Station. I really hope they manage to get back to London, given the last bus back to the station is around 6:30 p.m. Overall, though, it was positive to see the great number of people who attended this event, and it highlights the demand for live snooker that exists around Greater London and the South East. Just imagine the extra potential audience if all sessions were accessible to non-car driving fans. Well, thank you very much, Danny. And yes, I mean, you make a good point there about public transport. I do think that is a very important part of where we have tournaments. This Brentwood venue is a little bit, to me, like the one in Wolverhampton, the Aldersley Leisure Centre, where they have the Players' Championship. The area itself is really strong for snooker, but the venue is not quite up to scratch, really, for an event of that size. And I think this possibly is the same. We saw the crowds at Brentwood. They were brilliant. So that's great. The catchment area for snooker is really strong. So maybe a different venue in Essex that does have these better transport links may be the way forward. But, you know, as always, the sort of financials come into it. I'm told they didn't pay for the Brentwood Centre. So that's obviously quite an attractive deal, I would imagine, for World Snooker. And the fact is, it was full. They can point to that. It was full. And that has to be, therefore, judged to be a success. Now, Brian Campbell, he says, on the latest 147 podcast with Sean Murphy and Phil Seymour, are there other podcasts? I didn't know this. It was mentioned in passing the players would like to see the misrule abolished. It must be a nightmare for refs in qualifying rounds and outside tables to reset balls when there's no TV image to refer to. Even when there is, it can take a few minutes to get a satisfactory outcome, which isn't great for the fans at the venue or those watching at home. Could a possible solution be, if the ref calls a miss, it's just an 8-point penalty with no resetting of balls, with a player who hasn't fouled either playing from where the cue ball has stopped or putting his or her opponent back in from that very spot. This may not be perfect, but surely an improvement on what we have. There's less stress on refs. There's still a heftier penalty for the miss with 8 points conceded. The frame keeps flowing for spectators. What are your thoughts? As ever, keep up the great work with the podcast. Along with the Talky Snooker podcast, it's really entertaining weekly listening. Well, of course, we're coming together later in the week, but I didn't hear this discussion, but it's not true all the players want the misrule abolished. I know that for a fact because they had the opportunity to change it a few years ago. It was put to a vote and various options were put forward and the players chose to stick with it as it is. So clearly they don't all want to change it. In terms of your 8-point penalty idea, I mean, it's an idea, I guess, if the penalty, as you say, was heftier, then, you know, the players would be under more kind of impetus to actually make contact the first time. Very often a lot of these snookers, particularly if they're playing a sort of two-cushion, you know, glancing blow escape, the first one, they're almost playing to miss because it's kind of a guide. They don't want to go veer the other way and catch them too thick. So, you know, there's no actual great impetus to hit it the first time. The referees, yeah, I mean, the only issue really is if other balls move. If it's just the cue ball, it's not actually that difficult, really, to agree to where it was. Obviously, if other balls move and they start sort of dispersing around the table, then maybe that is more of an issue. But I'm not entirely sure it's true that all the players want to get rid of the misrule. In fact, I'm pretty sure they don't. Now, James Cook, he says, first of all, I need to start with an apology for various reasons. I'll spare you the details. I'm a few weeks behind on my snooker podcasts. I just started to catch up today. To my disappointment, I not only missed your 25th anniversary edition, but also the previous one where you asked for memories of the past 25 years. So sorry for not contributing. For what it's worth, my three highlights are. Now, we started one which is 29 years ago. But anyway, I don't mind. He says, the 1993 World Final. I was in the Crucible to see Stephen Hendry beat Jimmy White. It wasn't a great match. He finished a session early. But it was amazing to be there to see Hendry lift the title. China Open 2010. Might have been 09. I was in the front row in Beijing to see Stephen Hendry play Ding. I think Ding won. It was a thrill to be so close, and I also had a brief chat with Michaela Tabb, who refereed the match. China Open 2011, or 10, depending on when the aforementioned match was. I watched Ronnie live in Beijing for the first and only time against Robert Milkins, I think. Sorry to be so sketchy on the details. I suppose I could have looked these things up, but I thought I'd respect the Snooker Scene podcast ethos of doing very little or zero preparation. Well, quite right. Finally, I wish you and all other podcast listeners happy holidays, as they say over here. And he said, I'll leave you with the skyline shot of Manhattan, which I took while listening to the podcast. All looking a bit grey, to be honest. Well, yes, thank you for the picture. Obviously, this is an audio service, but Manhattan is looking, well, as you say, quite grey. Now, we move on, I think, to Matt Tarrant. He's talking about a very important subject that has not been addressed by other podcasts, as far as I know. It's about time it was. Here we go. He says, down to the big question, why are there so few bearded ranking event winners? The Scottish Open final had possibly two bearded players. This is Gary Wilson and Joe O'Connor. When's a beard a beard? O'Connor's attempt is probably best described as stubble, but he didn't win. Wilson's was a more substantial effort, and maybe most people's eyes a beard. If there's a consensus that maybe the first ever bearded ranking event winner, we might have to debate whether we can call Anthony Hamilton's facial follicles a beard. Certainly not a full beard when picking up the German Masters. JV, of course, this is John Virgo, sported a proper beard for much of his career, but how many ranking event wins? I haven't looked at pictures of every ranking event trophy presentation, but from memory, I don't recall a Davis or a Higgins or any other ranking event winner wearing a beard, so step up Gary Wilson and claim your place in the history of the game, unless any fellow podcast listeners can point out the example which is evaded by memory. Maybe a beard impedes the cue action for most players, and Wilson, due to the way he sights the ball, is unencumbered by his beard. Maybe my beard is why I'm not on the Pro Tour. Yes, I'm sure that's the only reason, Matt. He then actually found a picture online of Rory McLeod, who did win a PTC, not a full ranking event, but he carried ranking points. Alain Robidoux, of course, was very much of the facial hair. He didn't win a ranking tournament. But Darren Morgan, for a while, who also didn't win a ranking tournament, he sported a bit of facial hair. Yes, you're right. I mean, you know, there's not a great history of bearded snooker players who've won tournaments. But Mark Williams favours stubble. I don't, like you say, though, the question is what is a beard? What actually qualifies? I'm sure there's a beard podcast out there that could rule on this, but it's not this one. Now then, Jennifer Best writes, congratulations on your 25 years working in snooker. The anniversary spectacular was a fitting way to mark it and a thoroughly enjoyable listen. I have the recall of a goldfish, so it was lovely to hear all the different memories. I might not have a great memory, but what I do have is an irrational dislike of a couple of players, if you were serious about hearing about those. Well, absolutely. We heard someone's nan the other week had a taken against Nigel Bond for no good reason, it seemed. Didn't like Nigel Bond. But anyway, Jennifer says, the two culprits are Mark King and Stuart Bingham, and their crime is being photographed bent over the table in a state of undress. Stuart Bingham in his boxers and Mark King in the scud. Not a phrase I know, but anyway. There's some things that just can't be unseen, and as a result, I tend to turn over when either of those two appear. I feel a bit bad about Stuart Bingham, as I think his pick was for charity, but he reminds me of an ex-boyfriend, so he's fighting an uphill battle. Having said that, there is hope, as I managed to watch some of his match at Meadowbank without too much discomfort. King, on the other hand, doubled down with his shirtless apology to Rhiann Evans, which was as off-putting as his naked pick. Now, just on that, Mark King, I think the Times do a thing, sporting bodies, where they essentially will photograph a sports person naked. Very tastefully done, you know, it's the Times after all. But Mark took part in that, and then, yes, he said something, didn't he, about the women's game, about the making a maximum, it was unlikely or something, and then got a bit of blowback online, so he recorded an apology, but there was no shirt involved, no top at all. And seems to have scarred Jennifer, at least. She continued. Well, we'll come to the rest of it shortly. But of course, I remember years ago, someone had the bright idea: why don't we have you get these naked calendars? You know, the calendar girls, famously, and all sorts of professions now seem to have them. Someone had the bright idea of doing one in snooker, but who would the 12 be? I mean, I'm not sure we want to delve too much into this, but who would be Mr. August? I don't know. I suppose there's a few candidates, but anyway. It sounds, from what you're saying, Bingham and King would not be on that list. Let us know if anyone has any ideas about that. In the meantime, On the subject of the Scottish Open, there seems to be a lot of positive noise around the event, and rightly so. I wasn't sure what to expect with Meadowbank being a new venue, and having heard some of the views on other venues. But it turned out to be a great experience. The venue was comfortable, great views of multiple tables, and plenty of food options either at the venue or nearby. Snooker seems to get a bit of a bum rap compared to other sports, but I attended the Davis Cup and the Billie Jean Cup at the Emirates in Glasgow in the last few months. I thought the experiences were equally enjoyable, maybe just a bit less razzmatazz at the snooker, which is fair enough. I bought the early bird ticket for the Monday and enjoyed it so much I came back on the Wednesday. See, that's good, isn't it? The fact that you came back, that's very encouraging to know. Between the 2 days, I reckon I got to see about three quarters of the top 20 for £40, which for elite sport is exceptional value for money. I could have seen an extra couple of matches if I didn't have to get back to Glasgow at a reasonable hour. There's one thing that irked me slightly, though, and it was the amount of barking the referees were doing at the audience. I get it needs to be quiet, but continually berating the audience is irritating, especially when some of the noise was coming from outside the arena or from the playing side of the arena, e.g. the ref and the marker having a wee chat in the TV breaks. With four tables and matches rolling on and off, there will be movement in the audience, and I think some of the reaction was over the top, especially given audience members may have mobility issues and have already been sitting for hours and also were trying to be quiet. Maybe it's a particularly noisy arena, but that's not the audience's fault. The reason I mention this issue is I have friends who will watch snooker at home but won't attend a live match because they think they need to sit still for hours. I'd love to persuade them otherwise, but I don't really have the ammunition to do that now. Anyway, that issue aside, I had a ball and would definitely go back next year. Thanks for reading and best wishes for the festive season. Well, and to you, Jennifer. Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes the referees, they can be a bit abrupt, I think. Obviously, they need to call for order. If the multi-table situation on their match, if the next table is finished or they go into an interval, there'll be movement and they call for order. I think sometimes it can be a little more politely done, actually. I do tend to agree with you, because it's a little bit unreasonable to expect people to sit in absolute silence. And also, let's be clear, the intervals are for the public. They're not anything to do with the players or the matches. It's for the venue to sell drinks to the public. So therefore, they're well within their rights to leave and to go and get refreshments. People overwhelmingly try and do it quietly. The referees, obviously, they're trying to keep order in their match, so you can understand they want quiet. Maybe just a little, at times, not everybody, a lot of referees do it very politely. At times it can be a little bit, as you say, abrupt, and barking was the word you used. So I guess it's, as with everything, it's for the officials, it's kind of a balance. But, everybody there is trying to, the venue is trying to, be as respectful as they can be. It's a short podcast, as I say, because we've got the Christmas special coming up. But Callum Law, as I've been speaking, has emailed in. So I'm going to read that. I've not read this yet. There might be all sorts of vitriol here. I don't think there is. Anyway, let's read it out. Just me emailing in the aftermath of the English Open. At the end of a strange year, it was great to see Mark Selby back winning a tournament again. Clearly this year, Selby has been dealing with a greater challenge off the table than anything he's ever faced on it. But on or off the table, one thing that's abundantly clear is that you never count him out. Selby is one of snooker's great survivors and one of life's great survivors, a terrific champion. A word also for Mark Williams. It was great to see him make a maximum this week. He continues to entertain snooker fans in his own unique way. In my opinion, Williams is the most entertaining player to watch. His matches are never dull, always played in a great spirit, and he remains arguably the most likeable player on tour. There's much to look forward to in 2023, but it'll do well to top the storylines conjured in 2022. Thanks for all the great podcasts this year, and Merry Christmas when it comes. Callum Law. Well, thank you, Callum. That's very kind of you. And as Callum says, Selby has faced adversity on and off table and has met the challenge on both occasions, hasn't we? I thought it was a very good tournament. People weren't sure about Brentwood. It's not the best venue. I think it's fair to say we heard people writing in about the sort of the limitations of it. But clearly snooker's very popular there. There's a good atmosphere, lively atmosphere there all week. Obviously, it's day one began with Yan Bing Tao being suspended and, very upsetting for all involved off the back of the other suspensions. But to me, it's dispiriting that these things are being investigated. But it's only a crisis if we don't have the correct procedures in place to investigate. And the fact is we do. They were suspended very promptly. The easy thing for Jason Ferguson, the WPBSA chairman, to have done would have been to have just let it go this week and suspended him next week. But he took decisive action. And I'm sure that if there are charges to be met and punishments to be handed down further down the road, that will also be decisive. But ultimately, all of that gave way to a wonderful week of snooker. We had, as you say, Mark Williams entertained us. Plenty of players did. We had a lot of good snooker. The top players really seemed to thrive. There's a lot of talk about best of sevens being a lottery. The fact is they're not. you don't seem to get any more shocks in that format really than any other. We had a wonderful quarterfinal lineup, and in the end we had a great story, we had a great finish to the year. It's not quite over, of course. The Championship League has 4 days. That's getting underway. Groups 1 and 2 in Leicester. There's various platforms you can watch that on. Check out the Championship League website. Matchroom Live in the UK. Free Sports has gone now. It used to be on Free Sports, but that channel doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, so snooker isn't quite done, but this podcast is for now. But as I say, I'll be back with Nick and Phil, assuming we can get all the equipment to work, which is not a given. So we'll be back, I think, Thursday or Friday of this week. So check out the feed later on. I'll put up a thing on Twitter just to advertise it. Looking forward to that. They do great work. And we'll be joining forces for the second year running in... Because most Christmas specials you see on TV are recorded in July. But ours will be like Jules Holland's Hootenanny. It will be very much recorded in the festive period. I say that. I have no idea when he records that. We won't have Ruby Turner on. That's one thing I unfortunately tell you. But anyway, thanks for your correspondence. And if you hear this before about midday on Monday, there's still time to email for the Christmas special. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. But that's when we'll be recording it. So congratulations again to Mark Selby. I thought that was a wonderful evening of snooker. Great story, great achievement, great champion. But for now, as we always say, until the Christmas special, goodbye bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.